All right, this week's Parsha, we're coming up toward the end of the Torah. This is Parshas Nitzavim, one of the last Parshiot of the Book of Devarim. And the title of class is Parshas Devarim, the Prophet. Okay, so one of the most successful TV shows, reality TV shows on TV is a series called The Prophet. I think they've already had 10 or 11 years of episodes. So basically, the essence of it is that we have a person, Marcus Lemonis, who goes into struggling businesses, assesses it, and determines that he wants to help out both by management and buys a piece of the business, typically 51%, and gives them money to be able to renovate and basically allow them to have another lease on life. These are businesses are about to fail, so. Today we're going to look at a business called Standard Burger, which I guess was in Staten Island, to get a little sense. So, and of course, we'll go from that to the partial. So, without further ado, let us go to the videotape.
Tonight on The Prophet,
a burger business in New York City.
Don't be shy with the sauce.
Built by four best friends.
He had a dream. We had a passion. I don't know where the went.
Who now can't get along.
So why the would you open up the restaurant on time? That's bull.
It's a dire situation.
I built it for my brother, for my family. I feel I failed them. I really do.
Compounded by lagging sales and mounting debt.
How much are you losing?
5,000-6,000 a month.
If these guys can't get on the same page, it's just a matter of weeks before this business goes belly up. For 2 years, Sammy LaZoha has been bombarding me with emails asking for my help.
Marcus, it's a pleasure
hey,
to meet
Sammy.
You.
Sammy?
How are you?
How you doing?
It's
nice to meet you. We've been emailing for, what is it, 2 years now?
2 years?
You've been harassing me?
I originally did the build out, put my life savings in here.
How much have you put in?
Around 250,000. This is my partner, Joe Cavella.
Josie?
Josie, yes. Nice to meet you, Marcus.
Joseph. Trenchino.
Joe C, Joe T.
That's right.
Todd Baslin.
And you're just Todd. So is the restaurant making money?
No.
How much are you losing a month?
Currently in 5,000-6,000 a month.
When you don't have the money to pay the bills and you have to fight with your partners to pay the bills, it becomes an issue.
Who acts as the owner operator, the person that unlocks the door and locks the door?
Nobody.
Look, these guys all have full-time jobs, but in a business like this, you want to have at least one guy that's responsible for the business.
What is this back here?
So this is where we prep our patties.
You guys have frozen burgers?
Yes. We reform them, so it looks more handmade.
So they're not really handmade?
No.
Huh. Is everything frozen?
Yeah.
If you're telling me that your burger sets the standard, you kind of lost me at frozen.
So that's the Texan. You have bacon, you have fried onion ring, lettuce, barbecue sauce, American cheese, and cheddar.
Which is this one?
That's the double standard. It's basically a double cheeseburger.
What's in here?
That is the OMG burger. Jalapenos, American cheese, crunchy onions, and you have plantains.
Honestly, I would say the burgers are average. I mean, I have to be honest with you. These burgers and the menu concoctions, they sound like college campus drunk burger concoctions.
I thought this was a higher end burger establishment. That's all fresh ingredients and interesting things about it that make the burgers different or the fries different. What I really walked into was a burger joint.
Red velvet shake. You guys make those?
Yes.
So are shakes a big deal here?
Yes.
Are they good margins?
Yes. A lot of people love our shakes.
For every burger that you sell, how many shakes are you attaching?
Probably out of every three or four orders, there's a shake in there.
So 25% attachment?
Probably.
And what is the percentage of attachment for fries to an order?
Almost 80%.
Yes.
Look, in a business like this, most people would think that the money is made in the burger. But to be honest with you, it's made in other things. In this type of business, I think there's a lot more money to be made with French fries and ice cream, where the margins are 85%. The goal is making sure that you attach those things to as many burger orders as you possibly can. That's where the money's gonna get made.
Who came up with the red velvet idea?
So my brother Fuji helped me design the whole burger place when we were first.
Then why isn't he here?
The arguments.
Between you and him? Or?
No, between Todd and him. So they came to a point where they were watching the cameras 24/7.
What cameras?
the cameras in the restaurant. They'll watch him from home, and he'll get a phone call. Why is the refrigerator door open? You know, and he couldn't take the pressure anymore. He couldn't. And he walked away.
Yeah.
When we lost my brother, Marcus, we really lost the sense of the chef.
His brother doesn't work here anymore because we've all had issues with him.
Did he work? Did he come in early and stay late?
He lived here. He was like having you here when you're not here.
Fuji can get the job done. The problem is you need to give him that direction.
Micromanaging. They will micromanage you till they snap your neck. Literally.
Who will?
Todd in general.
Look, depending on who you listen to, Sammy's brother Fuji is either the guy who ran this business into the ground or the one who made it run.
Marcus, this is my older brother Fuji.
How you doing, my man? Nice to meet you. How long have you been in the restaurant business?
Since 14. I'm 41.
Since you were 14?
Yeah. My father was a chef.
Did you develop a lot of stuff here?
Yeah, the sauces, the burgers.
Why did you decide to leave?
Too many differences, too many pumping heads. Like, instead of having one boss, I had like four bosses.
It seems to be that the blame that you want to put is all on me. All I do is I try to make sure that it's not costing everybody more money. Because if we're going to talk honest, my partners will just spend and it don't matter.
Now, how do you function a restaurant with someone walking around telling you, we're not going to let them get paid training? You have to train them all together as a group while they're working. I don't spend 100% of my time here, but other people do. Is this place 100%
but actually,
successful?
None of you are here 100% of the time.
No.
The only person that was ever here 100% of the time at some point was Fuji.
Right.
Why don't you make me a burger? Let me see how different it is. What are you making here? What do you have in there?
Italian burger.
Fuji definitely has a different process than what I saw earlier. Not only is he using fresh meat, but he's taking the time to use the right spices and the right blends. That's how a specialty burger is supposed to be made.
Bring that knife, please.
Wow, looks good.
What do we got?
Wow, this thing's banging.
These burgers are way better than what I had earlier.
Did you try this one?
Unbelievable.
Which one is that one?
This is the blue cheese.
Let me get some of that. I'm starving.
I don't do this deal without Fuji in the deal. I can't. I'm not doing it. I'm not taking the risk. It's too dangerous for me.
I think Fuji should have some skin in the game. You know, you give him at least 10%. You know what I mean? Make it serious.
Here's my offer. If each of you whose businesses, primary businesses, are doing well, are willing to kick in $15,000 apiece, I'll kick in $130,000. Show me that it's not just...
All right. All right. You got the basic story. And of course, in profit land, and everything works out ever wonderfully ever after. Okay, so let's get down to some, let's do a little huzzah about the thing. So I'm not, welcome, Chaim, good to see you. What single decision was responsible for Standard Burger losing over $5,000 a month?
Removing the person who was running the business, essentially.
Who was running the business and who was a very talented chef who had the unique recipes to actually give them their distinctive food instead of it. Okay, good. So what was the personality flaw was underlying the poor decision to basically push them out?
They were all like micromanaging them. Like he had four bosses.
Right.
So he's getting calls about like, yeah, the same thing four different times.
Right. So basically, yeah. So they were not giving him any kind of autonomy or latitude. They're just breathing down the guy's neck. And he said, like, I don't need this. And he basically walked away. And when he walked away, they just had it. They were left with nobody who could really make the distinctive element. So therefore they had a regular standard burger joint with the frozen burgers. And therefore, people are not going to come back. And you know what? They didn't. And therefore, they were having a business that was losing $5,000 a month. All right. So how was Marcus Lemonis, as an outside business guru, able to help the business?
Oh, I mean, he pointed out, like, you know, this. Four different owners and nobody's here like opening the shop, closing the shop, running the business. Like they all have other jobs that they do.
Right. So he's, you know, as he walks in there, now, first of all, there's a couple of things. Number one is that he already has, owns many, many businesses. So he already has a intuition about, you know, he knows what's the basic recipe of a successful restaurant and what's the obvious errors are going to be made. So number one, you have people who are basically putting money in, but they're nobody's really spending that much time in the restaurant. And then he sees it. And then, of course, he does the first thing. Okay, your restaurant, let me taste it. Not good. And then it was not that far to figure, well, when was it good? Well, when they had the other guy there. And then he sees that no management. And being that, so therefore, he's clearly able to point out that they basically pushed out the secret of their success. Now, what was the what do you think was the cause of this source of inflexibility where these guys had to push the guy out?
They were butting heads too much.
Yeah, but they point to Todd, but maybe all of them were responsible. There was a sort of a inflexibility that was emerging here that caused the guy to check out. What's typically the cause of this inflexibility? That's insisting that he has to give the guy the direction every 5 seconds.
He thought he knew what was right, even though he didn't.
All right. So first of all, what was his defense that he gave? He gave a little defense because he got defensive, thereby saying, well, it's your dumb decision that caused us to have to leave the restaurant. So he started. What was his defense?
Nobody else is stepping up.
No, and he says you guys will just spend money like crazy. So what was he trying to do? By being very quote unquote careful with the business and making sure that the costs are being well monitored. By doing that, basically he was very as you said, micromanaging with Fuji. Now. But what is this? What do you think is the source of this type of inflexibility? Of not seeing the big picture, figuring out the consequences, seeing the situation. What makes people do this?
People that are very much stuck in their ways, also their egos. That they think they're right, they think they know best, and their ego agrees with them when in reality that's not the case.
Correct. In other words, they have a very fixed view. The way you run a business is like this. You run it with an iron fist, very tightly, you know what I'm saying? And meanwhile, not recognizing and became blinded to the fact that by acting so, rigidly, basically, and not giving the guy, an inch to breathe, that he's going to say, well, I don't need this. I'm out. So, that ego, that sense of I know better. Now, it could very well be that that person may be very successful in other businesses or in different scenarios that might work well. But you can't have one strategy for every situation. You have to be able to be flexible to recognize that, I'm not there. And if I'm going to be breathing down the guy's neck, he's going to leave. And then we're all going to be we're going to be up the creek, which he and others did not do because they all felt they're all anxious and they all feel they know better. So put those things together, a disaster. All right. So how did Marcus help them get through overcome their flaw? He did something actually rather genius. What if you ever have you watched this series of Profit? Have you seen a couple of shows?
I know who he is, but I've never watched the show.
Yeah, they're pretty good. They're pretty good. It's like 45 minutes. They're pretty good. It's one part business, but mostly he's functioning as a psychologist. Not that he is a trained psychologist, but fundamentally he's a kind of business psychologist. So what was the therapy that he he did, you know, I don't know if he was conscious about
it. He got them all together and he sat them down. He's like, what's wrong? Like, just say it. Like, this is your time to say your piece.
Well, he starts off very innocently. Well, what, you know, how's the business going? Oh, you're losing $5,000 a month. Okay.
And he's tough on him.
All right. So then he says, all right, so give me a sampling of your best burgers. Because you're a standard burger. We got to talk. And then he basically says, not in a mean way, he said, look, these are average burgers. These are average, you know. And if you're saying the standard burger, like you set the standard in burgers, well, you're not delivering what you did. And once he found out the other guy, he didn't say anything. Oh, how could you be mean to Fuji? He said, all right, Fuji, make the burgers. And then he put them out there and he had everybody taste them. And what happened? He didn't have to
they
say
were, a word. They were great, yeah.
He didn't have to say a word because those burgers were like were ridiculously way better and they knew it. And they saw, in other words, they tasted their mistake. They literally tasted their mistake. They knew that, you know, he's the star of the team over here. And then he goes and part of his deal says, okay, fine. So you guys put in another 15 grand a piece. We're going to give Fuji, 10% of the business, and I'm going to give 130,000, whatever. I'm going to put more. And he puts some more money in the whole business now, which of course for them, why are they going to be interested in giving so much equity, 51% of their business for $130,000? Why would they do that when they've already put in $250,000? And you know, what's the rationale? And plus, they've been working on it for years.
Well, one, they get him as like an advisor and a business partner.
Absolutely. He's worth more than just the cash infusion, number one.
Right.
He's an advisor.
Second is money.
And B is money. And bottom line is they know that if he walks out the door and they do business as usual, they're going to have to close that bit. They're going to have to basically write the whole thing off as an absolute and complete loss. You know what I'm saying? In other words, they're not in a great bargaining position right here. They basically have they're at their last, you know, they can't go on losing $5,000 a month. So basically they're going to go belly up in a month or two anyways. So they need that lifeline. So that's why he gave them 130, which is 50, more than 50% of the 250. So he purposely gave that and mentioned that amount. Now, ultimately, he spends far more money in the investment, but that's later on in the show. You can watch it. They posted on YouTube these 10-minute summaries instead of being 45 minutes. They sort of collapsed the show into 10 minutes. So you don't have to watch the whole show. You want to watch a 10-minute version. Anyways, so the bottom line is they're desperate. So basically, he was able to, instead of saying, he did not do it frontally, say, oh, you're being an idiot, you are being inflexible, you are, you know, with your micromanaging ways, you're basically crushing him. He did it very indirectly, in a very therapeutic way. All right, first we're gonna taste your burgers, okay? They're just average. Now we're gonna taste Fuji burgers. What do you think? These are amazing. Okay. Do we have a solution here, guys? I think we do. So as the way Shayna, you're not going to prove to the egotistical person that they're wrong by saying you're wrong. You're being a big fat ego head. You know, no, that's not going to be effective. He allowed them to come to that reality themselves. So. So what additional help would the inflexible person need to make ongoing progress in wise decision making? And how important would it be in the inflexible person's life to have such help? Like, do you think this problem that Todd or the others have is limited to the standard burger experience? Shayna's shaking. Yeah, what do
no.
you want to expand that a little more there, Shayna? Yeah, give us a little more. What do you mean?
I think this kind of boils down to, like, when we were talking about how these guys were just like very fixed in their ways and like they couldn't get past like that mindset. Anyone who's got that sort of fixed mindset needs that wants to change at least from a fixed mindset to a growth mindset or to get past whatever they're stuck at won't necessarily be able to easily do it on their own, but could use the guidance of someone like Marcus or some sort of coach or mentor to help them get past whatever that sticking point is.
Correct. Because if the person's inflexible in one area, it's likely they're going to be inflexible because you said before the inflexibility is coming from their sense of, ego. I know better. Well, the person who is the I know better guy or gal does not limit it to one area. They feel they know about everything in that way. To gain that humility, the way that Marcus did it, he did it in a very non-confrontational way, where basically he allowed them to see the folly of their decision themselves. And also they're feeling the pain because they're all having to put in money into a failing business. There's nothing worse than that. Here, take $5,000 and burn it. I mean, you know what I'm saying? And with no real plan for success. That does not feel good. That is a painful situation. So that's the deal. All right. So with that background, now let's get to our Parsha. Our Parsha is welcome, Chaim. Okay, we'll get to Nitzavim. Here we go. All righty. All right, so Shane and Vaksha, read it out. Four psukim tonight.
This mandate that I am prescribing to you today is not too mysterious or remote from you. It is not in heaven, so that you should say, who shall go up to heaven and bring it to us so that we can hear it and keep it? It is not over the sea, so that you should say, who will cross the sea and get it for us so that we will be able to hear it and keep it? It is something that is very close to you. It is in your mouth and in your heart so that you can keep it.
Okay. So there is a debate. There's an argument about when they say this mandate, which is it says a mitzvah zot, mitzvah. What mitzvah they're referring to? So on one level, it seems to be talking about the mitzvah of Torah, of learning Torah. Or there are three possibilities. It's either learning Torah, all of Torah, or three, tshuva. Because right before this, we're talking about the Jewish people returning in tshuva. So. But we're going to take it in the position of talking about Torah study, which is the way that the Gemara learns it out. These, of course, are not mutually exclusive. It can be yes and, okay? But I'm just giving you, alerting you that there's a debate about what is the mandate you're referring to. Okay. All right. So what fear or concern would a Jew with the mentality of the partners of Standard Burger have with the Torah?
That's a loaded question, Rabbi. I guess for somebody who's taking the Torah literally and is focused solely on the written word and not the oral law and the traditions that have gotten.
I'm saying a Jew. Let's say a Jew that accepts the oral law. I'm not talking about a Karaite. A Jew with the mentality of the partners of Standard. Even though the partners of Standenberger were Italian guys from Staten Island, each guy, I mean, like they were literally like stereotypes. It's like a little ridiculous, Joseph C and Joseph T and whatever Fuji. That's not his real name. Anyway, so it's Italian names.
Somebody could say that this is very restrictive, that there's no flexibility in it, that. Another approach could be, well, how are we supposed to do this if there's nobody to hold our hand and help us through it?
Right. It's overwhelming. It's a lot. I mean, look what Moshe is telling them. He's trying to remove the fear. It's not mysterious and remote to you. In other words, it's not esoteric. It's not totally high. It's not in heaven that you all say, oh, well, how are we going to know? It's too far from us. Or it's not over the sea. Who's going to cross it and get it for us? Rather something very close to you in your mouth and in your heart so you can keep it. Okay, but on the initial blush, it is overwhelming. So how does Moshe address his fear? So how is Moshe addressing their fear?
Well, I'd say that last pasuk, he's saying that it's internal to us, that it's something that's almost innate within us. It's part of our values. It's going to come from our parents and what our parents teach us and our homes, and that it's really not that difficult because it's so internal and innate to who we are as people who are born Jewish.
Right. It has a. He's arguing it's not something foreign. It's something natural. But now I'll add the question: who is better able to understand Moshe's point? The partners before the intervention of Marcus, or the partners after the intervention, and why? In other words, Marcus basically came to people who are frozen in fear. We are standing around a failing business, which is draining our resources at a $5,000 to $6,000 a clip, and we do not know what to do. Okay, so that is a bad place to be in. They were petrified. If they had a solution, they would have used it. They basically had exhausted all their options. And Marcus basically does a business intervention. He points out kindly their psychological issues, making aware that they have certain blocks. He helps them overcome a number of them. He gives them new cash to be able to be successful, etc. So who can be more open to agreeing with Moshe? Oh, it's not far, but it's something very close to you. The Jew who is sort of before the intervention or after intervention?
After the intervention.
Yeah, why?
Because of the lessons that you just described, that they're being taught, that they have a coach, a guide, someone who is walking them through it and showing them like this really isn't that difficult.
Right. You can't, Judaism and Torah specific on the onset and even very early on is very intimidating. It's very intimidating and seems impossible. So without, you need to have a coach who can help a person overcome these challenges. All right. So interestingly, the Ibn Ezra says it's close to you in your mouth and in your heart. All right, Scott, read it out. You're on mute.
Sorry. Ibn Ezra, it is in your mouth and in your heart, for the leave heart is the core of the commandments. Some commandments require the uttering of statements which serve to reinforce the heart. Others consist of deeds so that a person will utter the required statements.
Okay, so the Ibn Ezra is focusing on, it's something very close to you, it's in your mouth and in your heart so you can keep it. So he's saying the mitzvos, he's saying the essence of the mitzvah is really in the lev. Now, the word lev in the Tanakh can refer to sort of either the seat of emotions, how people say, oh, he's very, the person broke their heart, so that's an emotional state. Or lev can be like lev chacham, the mind, what we call in modern English, the mind. Here he's using in the sense of lev means mind. We're saying that the heart, the mind, is the core of the commandments. Some commandments require the uttering of statements to reinforce the heart. What will be an example of a mitzvah that requires you to say words? What are the mitzvahs that require saying stuff that reinforce the mind?
A brachot before we eat.
100%. So before we eat, we're really we're praising God, blessed you, God, King of the universe, who created the fruit of the tree, to focus on the fact that Hashem is the sustainer of all things. Or we say Shema, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. God is the Lord, hero Israel. The Lord is our God. The Lord is uniquely one. So it brings to mind our thoughts about Hashem. So we verbalize it, which will then trigger in our mind certain thoughts. And then we have deeds. We have certain mitzvahs. We're going to blow a shofar. We're going to shake a little. We're going to live in a sukkah. Okay. So it'll, which will bring out certain statements. So he's trying to unify all the mitzvahs, which are either thought, speech, or deeds, are all there to show that really they're really all there to help focus our mind on certain important things about Hashem and how he relates to the world. So, so according to the Ibn Ezra, all mitzvot stem from the mind, you know, or for the mind, the lev, as he says. How could this point be used to build on the insights of the partners? The partners had a certain problem. What are in a certain sense the mitzvahs trying to address?
As a blueprint, as a guide, as direction.
Yes,
in other words, after the fact, they could see that there was an instruction guide here. If they could have followed him, they would have been close to their, you know, present for it in there and thought it through. Right? They could. It's there for them to see and to connect to also.
Correct, but it would have helped them. It would have been helped them to overcome the certain. It would have solved certain problems. In other words, the problems that they had was what we call in Hebrew a midot problem. The problem was that they had very set views, very inflexible. So the instruction that Marcus provided, or the instruction the Torah can provide, helps us to ensure to get us out of a very inflexible mindset. Okay, if they would have had quote unquote mitzvos, you know, it would have got them out of it could help a person get out of a very arrogant, inflexible, fixed view mentality. So that gets into question 12, is what really is the prime challenge to Torah learning and living is really the sense of a certain midot problem. In other words, what makes it hard is that I have a certain fixed view about things. And therefore, when it goes against, you know, so therefore any part of Judaism that goes against the way I feel about things, that's going to cause a certain friction and makes it very, very difficult. You know what I'm saying? So it requires a learning, requires an intervention, requires a new way of looking at things. That's how a person's having difficulties because they're stuck in a fixed view. All right, let's take a look at the Rambam here, which he makes a different application. All right, Shana Bavakasha.
It is written about the Torah. It is not in the heavens. It is not across the sea. This implies it is not in the heavens, i.e. it is not found in the arrogant spirited. It is not across the sea, i.e. it is not found in those who travel across the sea.
It doesn't mean across the people who are constantly involved in business. In other words, they're constantly doing business trips. So he's talking about, this is talking about the mark of excellence of people who grow significantly in their Torah study. It's not about so much having a big IQ. What do they identify? And the Gemara actually expands a little more. So read the Gemara. This is where the Rambam got it from.
Rava said, it is not in heaven, means that Torah is not to be found in someone who raises his mind over it like the heavens, i.e. he thinks his mind is above the Torah and he does not need a teacher. Nor is it to be found in someone who expands his mind over it like the sea, i.e. he thinks he knows everything there is to know about the topic he has learned.
Right. So what is the major obstacle that the Rambam and the Gemara say that when it says lo bashamayimi, it's not in heaven, and it's not in lo ba'ever hayam, it's on the other side of the ocean, what problem is it pointing to? What is the big challenge about making a breakthrough and growing in Torah?
Hubris,
pride, arrogance. Yes. I know better. I don't need to know. or coming to a topic with very fixed views and not being open to suggestion. Basically, like the partners of Standard Burger. In other words, we know how to run a restaurant. Oh, it's failing. Okay, so it's interesting that the challenge of growing in Torah. Now we're a couple of days away from Rosh Hashanah, and want to figure out pathways of growth. Interesting. It's not about learning of Torah. It's not about having a great IQ. It's about more important than that is humility. Now, obviously, and also in the next thing, which he mentions is, putting the time in. Obviously, you can't, if you learn for 5 minutes a week, you're not going to gain a lot. There's a limit. You got to put the time in. But even if you put a lot of time, but a person is arrogant, they're not going to grow in Torah. It's interesting. The quality that the Parsha teaches us is the quality of humility, of not in heaven, not one who races his mind over it like the heavens. Okay. So how could Marcus Lemonis use the case of Standard Burger to point out the true cause of difficulty with Torah study to the arrogant person? What could he do? How could Marcus Lemonis universalize and expand this experience by the burger place, by Standard Burger, to be really is a cause of all the difficulty in Torah study? To the arrogant person. The true cause of difficulty of Torah study to the arrogant person.
They're not going to be able to learn the lessons because they think they know how to interpret it and not listen to the great, rabbinical sages.
Right. So they already come of course I know what it is. And even if they don't, they can't admit it.
And they won't take somebody else's opinion.
They won't take anybody. They won't. They may not even listen to another person's opinion, much less take it. So this is not so simple. To be open to hearing different ideas, different perspectives, is apparently not such an easy thing for many, many people. All right, so let me flesh out some examples. Three scenarios. Scenario number one, Nancy MGR has been a Balat Shuva for a while. She is finally comfortable going through the year and knowing what to do. She feels that she does not have to learn. I want to say better. She feels a lack of motivation. To learn that often. What would the Parsha and Marcus Lemonis help her attain new heights of growth? What do you think is happening with her? Why was she able to learn before and now she's having difficulty learning now?
Well, she feels a lack of motivation because she's trying to do it herself, not with a partner.
Well, even if let's say she had a chavrusa, but now, see, there's a major change that happened with her. It says now she's finally comfortable going through the year and knowing what to do, which implies that before she did not know what to do. So what's the new change of her life and how has her Judaism in a certain sense changed? Shana?
Because she feels she knows what to do, she doesn't feel the need to learn the way she had before she knew what to do.
What was in part motivating her in her early years?
Could be desire to learn something new. Could be she felt her religiousness was lacking, that she wanted to be more observant. And therefore she needed to learn in order to know what to do.
That's true. But also there's another component to that. Which is a major thing. Whenever I would interview people for the fellowship, they'd always mention this. They always mention the following scenario. Rabbi, when I walk into a synagogue, I feel that everybody's looking at me and they know that I don't really know what's going on. They know, and I'm afraid that the Gaba is going to come if he's a guy. I'm afraid that the Gaba is going to call me up and ask me to do something like a Hagba or a Glila or an Aliyah. And I don't want to be outed. Okay? So there's a tremendous amount when the person's in the early years of being a Baal Tshuva, there's a tremendous amount of anxiety of being outed as somebody who doesn't know within in a community that seems to know a lot more than them. So there's a lot of, so there, that can be a fuel to for a person to up their game so they can be, they can remove that, that social friction. Okay. So with here, with Nancy, she has already hit that. You know what I'm saying? She knows how to light Shabbos candles. She knows how to bench. She knows how to dive. She knows how to run a kosher. You know what I'm saying? So a lot of things, though, she, in a certain sense, her level of socialization in the community is much greater. You know what I'm saying? So she doesn't, quote unquote, stick out. So that, so does she feel motivated socially to learn? To gain the skills to be socially united with the community? Does she have that same motivation? No. Because she fits in like everybody else. So that's a new phase. So when the person hits that new, and that's why many, many even modern Orthodox Jews who went to 12 years of yeshiva education, maybe did a year in Israel, you'll see some of them, they don't learn that much. Now, why? A, because they know what to do. Rosh Hashanah goes in order, they got it all down. They know what, they know how to do practically. And you know, they don't feel so inspired and so intellectually curious. So therefore, they got very little motivation to learn. So the Baal Tshuva is, number one, is motivated, A, because they're curious. They don't really, they're interested in exploring. They are motivated because they socially, if they want to join that community, they know that they have to learn some more to become more literate and as a functioning Jew. So they have way more motivation, you know, and oftentimes they're a seeker, or they're a person who is trying to seek answers to these more these questions. People who are born into it, it wasn't really a decision. They didn't choose Judaism. They were born into the Judaism. So therefore, you know, they're in a certain sense, much more challenging situation. They're very much like the, so by extension, they're more much like the partners of Standard Burger. In other words, they have a fixed view. This is what we do. Now, you guys have learned with me for many years. everything is, there's no, Judaism is complicated. There's a lot of stuff going on here. And to gain clarity is not such a simple thing. So to feel that you're kind of done in your Jewish education is a little bit, you know, a little bit arrogant, you know what I'm saying? So, to be open to new ideas and exploration, that's how you really grow. So that's what Marcus Lemonis would could say. He could say, look, I'm as a business person, I'm going into new business situations to grow. I'm sure that you as a Jew, you've come a long way, but there are more things you could learn and become a better version of yourself. You know what I mean? That's what he could say that, and it would be true. So that's the, that's a factor. That's a factor here. Let's go on to scenario number two. Stan Amgier seems to be getting, seems to always get into the same petty arguments with the roommate Jeffrey. Either it's fighting over restocking the refrigerator or it's about who should be washing the dishes. Nothing seems to change. What would the Parsha and Marcus Lemonis help him attain new heights of growth in his relationship?
Holding his tongue.
Okay. That.
I'm sorry. I'm late to the class. I was late, but I said it's better to be late than not to join. So.
Correct. Right. You're right about that. And that's true, by the way. Just to build off what Jay just said, there's a phrase from Pirkei Avot. You guys have probably heard it already. Siag lechachma shtika, a fence for wisdom is silence. You get yourself, you can avoid a lot of problems by not saying stuff. It's that desire to tell the guy off for Stan to, you know, rip into Jeffrey for forgetting to pick up the milk. And now we don't have, now it's time for coffee in the morning and there is no milk. And whose fault is it? It's Jeffrey. It's his turn to pick up the milk, to restock the fridge. Did not do that. Or it's NFL Sunday and lo and behold, we need chips and there are no chips. And it was Jeffrey's turn. Okay. The same basic thing. So, but what would the Parsha, you know, in the broader sense, and Marcus Lemonis could be able to help the person, A, not by just talking, but to solve the problem.
I also heard, Rabbi Pinion, I forget where I read this, that like when people do this type of thing, there's two sides of it, right? There's the person who's it's being done to, where Shemayim decreed that this person was going to be the one to mete out the punishment for them for whatever it was, right? And then that person who actually meted out the judgment, who was the stick, the rod, whatever you want to call it, the messenger, they have a free will choice of either to do it or not to do it. And if they choose to do it, then the books are opened on them and then they are judged.
But you're talking that Laura talks about, that's more of a case of a capital case. You were talking about,
okay.
That's elevated to that, the most extreme case of
okay.
You know, basically a person getting their just desserts in a certain kind of way. Here we're dealing with a much more lower you know, a struggle where people are trying to get along. You know, over the years, how many times did Rabbi Wiles and myself have to deal with roommates who are having disputes?
Right.
Just okay. It's hard for people. It's hard for people to get along. You know, living together is hard. You know, you're married. Right. Hard. It's hard. Okay. You know, just FYI. You know what I mean? Just to let everybody know that. So to get along takes a lot of wisdom. And what the Parsha is pointing out is that particularly the Gemara here is talking about that if you want to grow in learning, not just into Torah learning, but learning of life, you can't have a fixed view. You can't be arrogant, which is to say, maybe I am handling this in a wrong way. Maybe working with Jeffrey and yelling at him all the time is maybe not an effective solution. Maybe sitting having a conversation about maybe we can create a system together, whether it be on an app or on a whiteboard or whatever it is, and then we work it out. Maybe find a way out that we can solve the problem instead of just letting it go. Then the problem happens, and then we get in a yelling match. And then okay, maybe that's not the best way to solve that problem. So. But that's the situation. So the Torah is close to us if we get the instruction to overcome. You know, when we come to it with an open mind, with a spirit of humility. Last case, scenario number three: Stacy MGR's mom Barbara is always critical about religious Jews and Judaism. Whenever Stacy and Barbara are together, the same issue gets brought up. What would the Parsha and Marcus Lemonis help them attain new heights of growth in their relationship? This is a very common problem. I've dealt with this numerous times, that the person who has become more observant, it then goes home. Oftentimes, either that MGR becomes the ambassador for all things Jewish. They have to explain about all things Judaism. And it's oftentimes a tremendous source of friction. You know, has anybody seen this phenomena before? I'm getting
in my own family.
Say it again.
In my own family, with my mother and my brother. But again, I know it comes from a different place. Like with the things that they say and do, I know that it comes from anger and upsetness in their lives, and from my mother, from my father being, you know, married to my father, a lot of it stems from that. And she takes it out on this. So I deal with it all the time and I just kind of ignore it. I mean,
that's one strategy is that you can't solve it, but don't make it worse. You know,
exactly.
Right, and that might be a good solution. The question is there any way to, is there any, you know, if I'm going to be open and try to be humble and try to find a way, could there be other possible solutions? Chaim, you're raising your hand, Chaim.
I was just saying I've dealt with it, you know, and that's and I've seen it. But as far as
how to solve it, so what would be a non-Govalet?
Be very, you know, PC. You know, we at this table we don't discuss religion or politics. You know, also to talk about things of connection and like mitos and character traits as opposed to right and wrong and halacha and other things. Where there might be judgment, right? So if you give a feel-good message, if you give it to the right Torah, you say, hey, I'm not the rabbi. You could ask your rabbi on that. But, you know, I'll say, you know, when you talk about the Parsha or Abraham, and you talk about the idea of chesed and hosting people and midos, that nobody's going to argue with about. And the connecting with the core values and principles of Judaism on the spiritual level and altruistic level, nobody's going to say anything boo about it.
Right. Well.
Also, I guess, picking your conversation.
Possibly, but no, but that. What you're talking about is a good methodology when you're dealing with people who are, you know, when you're presenting to people who are not Orthodox. But here is a more sticky case, which
understanding your question, what you're asking me specifically.
Well, no, so I think your answer is true in the general sense, but it gets more complicated when the people involved is mother and daughter, which is a complex relationship. So Jane's solution is just to not, you know, to avoid the topic altogether, just sort of like avoid it. That's one approach, and there's a wisdom to that. But again, the Torah is saying that part of getting a solution, of getting more wisdom in Torah is humility, is to start with the thing that, well, maybe the way that I've been approaching it is not necessarily the only way, and there may be even a better way. Just having that openness of possibility. It may not, by the way, I'll ask the question in a different way. Could the four partners of Standard Burger come to this understanding about their business without Marcus Lemonis? Do they only have to have Marcus Lemonis come to help them? Could they have theoretically come to this themselves? Scott, you're on mute, so I don't read lips.
Sorry. Yeah, sure. Theoretically, they could have, but nobody would have had like that spark or, you know, that thing to like be like, listen, we're going down the wrong path. We got to bring back.
What did it really take? What do they really need?
Someone pointing out that they stick at what they're doing.
Well, it's more because the Midot problem was an arrogance. Of course, we know what we're doing. But if they said if they were able to get into a place of humility and say, you know something, obviously that what we're doing is mistaken. Let us sit and say when were we successful? What was the ingredient there? And maybe we need to find that ingredient. In other words, they could have made that. They could have done. This is really what the Marcus Lemonis case was. He helped them do tshuva because they were arrogant and they treated the guy improperly, and therefore they were unsuccessful. Conversely, so too in the Stacy and with Stacy and Barbara, there could be ways to get a better relationship. The truth is the most fraught relationship is between mother and I find it very infrequently that mothers and daughters get along. It's like a rarity. It's a hard relationship. It just is. I don't know. I mean, there are reasons. But so then you're going to add mothers and daughters plus with a religious difference. That's a tough one. That's a tough one. Now, it takes. Now, it will take a lot of you know as with the Rambam and the Gemara teaches us that the growth, the pattern of growth, the ingredient of really growing as a person and in Torah is the quality of humility, saying, I don't know, and I'm open to learn, and let me explore, and let me find different possibilities, and ask different experts, and get an insight. That ability is getting people out of their comfort zone. People do not like feeling. People do not like the state of saying, I don't know. because when I say I don't know means I'm also, I'm not in control. So that is very scary. So therefore people will, it's easier. It's more initially comfortable to say, I do know. Because it gives a sense, an initial sense of security. Here, what Marcus Lemonis pointed out was able to do is without them feeling bad, allow them to come to the awareness that they were made a grave mistake. And our Parsha is teaching us that the secret for growth in Torah and life in general is in any kind of pursuit is starting off saying, I may have some answers, I don't have all the answers. And with that mentality, with a growth and education-minded perspective, a person can go a great way. You can have success in your business, in your relationships, and in your Judaism. And that really is what the Parsha, and in a certain sense, and the truth there, in a certain sense, becomes very close to you, becomes very natural to you. But what the separates between us and the Torah is our the emotions that... feelings of arrogance is a major problem, and a person could be accept humility and recognize I know something, I don't know everything, is can be a tremendous power of growth in their life, and to be open to look at situations in new ways, not having fixed views. In other words, the person who has fixed views, as Shane pointed out, is essentially arrogant. So a person who is flexible and being open, like I'm not the source of wisdom, is really the gateway for growth, and both in Torah and in life in general. And that's why Moshe says, that's what the Talmud is adding. It's not far from you. The Torah is very close to you. It's very close. Yeah, it's very close if you're going to approach it with humility. That's what the Talmud says. It will be very close to you. It will be very natural. It will be relatively easy if you're going to come to it with a perspective of humility. That's what the Gemara and the Ram add there. And that mentality is true what happened in the failed business, and true in situations of difficult relationships. With humility, you can be open to new possibilities and therefore new ways of doing things, and then opportunities for success. And that really is a life lesson that the Parsha grants us. Any questions? Okay. I guess hopefully that was clear. All right, guys. So I want to wish you all the best. I'm not going to see you. All right. So next Tuesday will be Rosh Hashanah. So, so we're not meeting next week. I want to wish everybody a Shana Tova, a Ksiv Zima Tova, a good Givench Yor. And Shana's got a question.
No, we're missing the next four Tuesdays.
Oh, wow.
Next Tuesday is Rosh Hashanah. The following Tuesday is Erev Yom Kippur. The Tuesday after that is the second day of Sukkot. And the Tuesday after that is Simchat Torah.
Woo! So let me wish you a Shana Tova, an easy, meaningful fast. A chag sameach for your sukkahs, and a chag sameach for your shmini atzeres and simchas Torah, and yeah, that's a lot.
Okay. Is there any other opportunities to hear you or tap into Rosh Hashanah, Divrei Torah, or Yom Tov stuff online with you?
I do have 1,000 classes on YU.
Not YU.org. I'm saying, is there any night a week that you're doing something else that we can join?
Teaching. No, we're starting. We're revving up the senior fellowship on the Wednesday after Simchas Torah, which is the next day after Simchas Torah. So the answer is not that I'm aware of. Not yet.
So there's no classes for the next couple of weeks.
Not till I know. So basically,
there's no interest in the next 4 weeks.
To summarize what Shane is.